Hey, Riddles in the Dark listeners, Dave here with a couple of quick audio-related notes before we get started. For one, there's a couple spots where Corey basically completely cuts out for very brief moments of time. Sorry, we had connection issues. We worked them out for most of the episode, and it didn't seem worthwhile going back and trying to re-record just the little short bits. So we're sorry that those parts are missing, and hopefully it doesn't detract too much from your enjoyment of the episode. Second of all, listener Alex pointed out on the Facebook page that there's a little ambient noise coming from my end of things, I just want to apologize, and I promise I will make more of an effort to utilize the mute button and to minimize the amount of background noise that you get while Corey's talking. All right, let's get on to the show. Good morning, Riddles in the Dark fans. We are back for yet another episode after, well, you got episodes released relatively steadily, but it was in fact a hiatus because I was gone for a few weeks for vacation, but we're back. We've got some serious business to take care of, we should get right to it. I am one of your co-hosts, Dave Kale, and let me introduce my partner, the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson.
Good morning, everybody. Yes, it is a little bit strange because since Dave was on vacation, we had to pre-record that last episode. So to me, it feels like a really long, I want to say welcome back. But of course, it's been kind of normal for everybody else. But I'm eager to get back into talking about things.
That is right. So let's actually, before we go too far, I think we want to do just a couple of really quick announcements. One is that we just launched our new companion series, if you will, called Riddles in the Dark Digest. These are fun little episodes that I'm going to do that will be released approximately bi-weekly, alternating with the main episodes that basically review the discussion that our main episodes have generated over the preceding week or more. And in particular, I will be addressing feedback we get from our listeners and fans, all you smart people that we interact with on the Mythgard page, Facebook, Twitter, and stuff. And then also review the predictions and discussion and arguments that we get from our analysts participating in our prediction game. And some of them are kindly sending us content for these episodes, either recordings of them discussing it or textual blurbs that I read. So it's basically a good chance to hear what other voices have to say, including some of our analysts, but also you, the listener. So those are fun little episodes.
Yeah, I think this is great. I'm really excited about this angle of things. This is one of the things that I like best about doing this, is that, of course, although it's, sufficiently fun to sit around and talk about this stuff. The really fun thing is to be getting the other people involved and seeing what other people have to say and really making this a wider discussion. I'm really excited about that.
Me too. And they're actually kind of fun to do, to sort of go back over everything and remind ourselves what the arguments are. And especially since there's such wide perspectives and disagreements amongst our analysts. So, the other thing that we want to announce is that I don't think we've decided whether it will be 2 weeks from now or a month from now, but sometime in the month of April, we're going to do the big one. That's right, the split. Where will the split be?
Yes, where will the first film end? Exactly. This is the question we've been not exactly avoiding, but we've been kind of waiting to get to, because of course it's a big question. One of the things, there have been a lot of topics that people have been interested in hearing us talk about or want to get involved in a conversation about, but we've been trying to restrict our topics of conversation so far to things which are going to be in the first film, because of course, we're going to talk about the second film. But obviously, if we're making a lot of predictions right now in, March and April of 2012, that won't be confirmed or denied until December 2014. that is a depressingly long amount of time to wait. So we're going to focus on the shorter term and look at this first film first. So, you know, for instance, we had people who wanted to talk about the Arkenstone. I'm really excited to talk about the Arkenstone, but we're probably not going to do that for a little while because we're trying to hold off. But of course, like, you know, there's this fundamental question. Exactly where does it end? Where do we think is going to that line is going to be? Where exactly should we be restricting ourselves to? So anyway, that's definitely something I'm looking forward to kind of hashing out.
Yep. So we're going to do something. My plan, I don't know what it will be yet, but we're going to do something a little bit different for that episode just to make it a little bit more fun. Either solicit your feedback, listeners, beforehand or something. So basically keep your eyes open on the Tolkien Professor and Mythgard Facebook pages and Twitter accounts for announcements about that.
Yes.
All right. The next thing we want to do is listener feedback, since it's been piling up and we haven't been able to address it for a month, and there were starting to be not complaints but grumblings on the Mythgard page, like, I don't think they're paying attention. So we are. The first one that I want to give you a chance to have a Tolkien Professor moment, Corey.
Yes.
One young lady, Kate Nagel, on your Facebook page said, I love listening to you guys on my walks. Yesterday I noticed you kind of elided over the SH of Tookish when talking about Bilbo. Made me wonder, if Yiddish were spoken in Middle Earth, who would be the first to make a joke about Bilbo's ancestors? One of the dwarves, a brandy buck, or a tra-la-la elf?
A tra-la-la elf. Clear.
Yes. Clearly. I agree.
Like, they are totally no holds barred when it comes to making fun of people. So yes, absolutely. No question. A tra-la-la elf. Kate's great. She's one of our Mythgard students. I know her pretty well. She is fantastic and always asks colorful questions.
Yes. Okay. All right. The next one comes from, and this is the one I told you about last night. The next one comes from Stephen A. Simpson, and this was on the Mythgard page. So to those of you commenting on the Mythgard page posts, wondering if we noticed them, we do. And we really noticed this one. This is from our friend Stephen Simpson, who has a theory about Azog and Thror and Thrain and the Battle of Azanul Bazar. And I'll paraphrase it here, but basically his theory is that Thror will, you know, not only will there be some conflation between the Battle of Azanul Bazar and the Battle of Five Armies, and maybe some conflation between Azog and Bolg, but there will also be conflation between Thror and Thrain and the dwarves. Basically, the opening scene will be Thror and Thrain escaping from Lonely Mountain during Smaug's attack, and that will be the last time that we see Thror. And Thrain will somehow get the map during that sequence. The next time we see Thrain will be at the Dungeons of Dol Guldur, where he will be, where Gandalf will have encountered him, and then they will both be attacked by Azog, who's just apparently on a orc captain rotation visiting Dol Guldur, and he will behead Thrain in front of Gandalf at Dol Guldur, at which time Gandalf will escape with the key and map. Then Azog, who really gets around, will again appear at the Misty Mountains, where they won't manage to kill him. And finally, will reappear again at the Battle of Five Armies, and that's where Thorin will finally get his revenge before he is killed himself. What do you think, Corey?
I think that this suggestion is horrifying. and I find it horrifying because it is sickeningly probable.
Yes.
I never would have thought of this. But first of all, the one element that, like, as soon as he said it, I am just filled with dread, certainly about my prediction concerning Thror's head. But anyway, as soon as he mentioned it, I was like, how probable isn't it really probable that they're going to make Thror go down with the ship? You know, that he's going to die at the Lonely Mountain, that he's going to be like the desperate rearguard action and he's going to like give the map or something to Thrain or even to Thorin himself, while he like goes back to like fight off the dragon and die, so that the because, you know, it is a problem that the loss of the Lonely Mountain, what Smaug does, I mean, obviously, like, it's sufficiently bad in the book. It's not like it needs to be worse, but the reason for revenge is a little bit abstract. It's just like, they took our home, you know, and that's it's kind of moving and everything, but mightn't they want to jack that up a notch by having it like, you killed my grandfather? You know, like, I can see it. I'm not predicting it, but that element seems to me really, really likely, and that would totally chuck my Minds of Moria fantasies clean out the window.
Yeah, I also just thinking about it, the idea that there's all these old dwarves that are related to Thorin, and that they are just, there's like a multiplicity of them, and people might find them confusing. I could imagine them saying like, we need to really kill one of them off right off the bat and not put him back on screen again. I can really see that too.
Right.
Are you still there?
Yeah, to turn Thror into Elendil, basically, like how they handled Elendil in the film. Hmm.
Hey, Corey, do you want to...
Yep, I'm here.
Do you want to...
My connection... This was... Yeah, I was just thinking that.
All right. We're going to take a quick...
Why don't I disconnect and reconnect, see if we can get a better connection here.
Yeah, call me back.
Okay.
All right, let's see if this is a little bit better.
Okay, good. So far, so good. I agree. The multiplicity of dwarves question is an issue. Now, you know, one thing that's very clear from everything we've gotten, I mean, long before the trailer or anything was released, just when they started releasing the still pictures of the dwarves, it was very clear that one of the efforts that Peter Jackson is doing, you know, is he's putting forth a lot of effort towards is making the dwarves individualistic, so that they're not just this massive 13 dwarves. Is he going to go the extra distance to be like, oh, and also here's Thror and Thrian? You know, could he in some sense conflate those two characters, or at least, you know, take the actions of and the whole like wandering Azog thing, you know, again, I find it horrifyingly plausible, because of course that would make him into essentially a recurring villain, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, you can see how that would be really compelling for the film structure.
This has conjured in my mind visions of Azog following along behind them, dogging their every step.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it seems like, on the one hand, the full version of that seems a little hokey, you know. I mean, if he were really to pop up every time they turned around, then I think that could like devolve into comedy, which presumably they wouldn't want in that context. But basically to make him the recurring villain, like, you know, and therefore have a, like, you know, you killed my father, prepare to die moment at the end. Mm-hmm. I can see. Again, I do find it chillingly plausible that at least some elements of that theory could well turn out to be true. And, you know, like, I should say, the language I keep using about this, like, horrifying and chilling.
Ominous.
Things like that. Ominous. Like, I only say this because, and this is one of the reasons why I'm not a filmmaker. I could never do it. Like, I know that, like, the kinds of things you have to do in adapting storytelling to the film genre are things that would break my heart. Like, I don't think I could do it.
Yes.
So, like, as someone who just loves these stories and doesn't want to lose any element of it, like, I'm capable of appreciating and enjoying different versions of the story. But looking at it from this side and imagining, like, the story, it just, at this point, it feels the contemplation of it merely feels like a loss, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, whereas, because we're not in the process of enjoying and appreciating the story as it, you know, is going to unfold. So it may well be excellent. It probably, you know, who knows? Maybe that version would make a far better film story, than the version that I would quite like to see.
Yeah, yeah, but, I agree. You know, we use the negative lingo because out of, you know, humor and that kind of thing. And this is going to be sort of our little shtick, but we're not actually that negative.
No, I mean, it's like I said, it could be fine, but yes, the lover of these stories in me certainly hopes, because see, Thror. In the books, one of the important things about Thror is, I mean, he is the patriarchal character. If anything, actually, Thryan is the more minor one of the two, I think, because of course Thror's name is attached to things like the map, he is this figure of antiquity. He is the sort of the connection back through Thror and ultimately back to Durin that gives Thorin this stature, you know, that he is part, you know, in the way that we are invited through the books to picture Thorin as, you know, the wandering heir of this, you know, of this disinherited but ancient and noble family. Thror is a big part of that. You know, and so that's why I would feel it. That's why I, you know, from here, I would feel it as a loss, even if I understood it. Because, I mean, there are things that I would say are even true, you know, that are true that way of the Lord of the Rings films. Not that we want to get into a long discussion of that, but I mean, there are many things that I miss in the films that I think are a loss when I just think of the story objectively. They work fine in the films, but there are still, you know, elements
you miss them nonetheless.
That I miss. Exactly. Just as a lover of those story elements, I miss them when they're not there. Yeah. So I would miss Thror if he were gone. But yes, so but I certainly can see the argument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so another piece of feedback we got on the Mythgard page from Jason, who happens to be a fellow podcaster from the Outini Cast, OOTINICast.com, which is, I believe, a Star Wars The Old Republic MMORPG focused podcast. Outini being the All sound right. that the Jawas make.
Of course.
Yes, I thought you might catch that. So This is another Tolkien professor moment. He mentions It was brought up in the show that Frodo's appearance was chosen to be younger than his actual age. I didn't notice because I expected him to be to look young, at least as young as Merry and Pippin, due to the effects of the ring, yada, yada, yada. And I know that you wanted to address this point.
Yeah. I think that there was from comments we've gotten, I think that there's been a little bit of misunderstanding about our references to the alteration, which I called one of the biggest sort of character alterations in Frodo's character. No, I would say the biggest alteration in Frodo's character mm-hmm. is the fact that they make him young. And my point there is not about his appearance. Yes, it's true. As soon as he gets the ring, he begins to show signs of good preservation, and he doesn't seem to age. But two things. First of all, he's 33 when he gets the ring. He has come of age. Elijah Wood looked like a teenager, probably because he was a teenager when it was being filmed. That is, he looks young. If you just look at the bunch of them together, that is the four hobbits in the film, Frodo looks the youngest there. And the way he acts is also that way. Frodo was the oldest, significantly the oldest. He was 50 at the beginning of the quest. So the first point is the simple fact that in the film he looks young, but 17 years pass between when he gets the ring and when he sets out on his quest. And that 17 years vanishes in the films. And so it's not just for the sake of we got to speed this up so we can get the story moving. It has a profound character impact because Frodo is no longer, as he is in the book, the senior statesman among the hobbits. He is the clear leader because he is the senior, he is the most experienced, he is the most mature of all of them. And you can see clearly, for instance, in the book, this is one of the reasons for the demonstrable maturity difference between, say, Frodo and Pippin. Because Pippin is very young. Pippin is almost half Frodo's age. Just over half. He's 28, and Frodo is 50. So this is a huge difference. There is an almost there's essentially a generational gap between Frodo and the other hobbits. You don't get any glimpse of that. There is a, no matter how he looks, that there's a generational gap. So it's again, you know, I'm not saying like, you know, it's wrong or anything. They knew that they were doing this. And it was a deliberate choice on their part, and that's fine. But I would just say, like, but that was the point that I was trying to make, that it's a very significant choice to recontextualize Frodo as not only a young, appearing mature person, but a genuinely young, inexperienced, and naive person. And that really changes his whole character trajectory over the course of the story as it's told in the films, compared to the story as it's told in The Lord of the Rings. Frodo is not a coming-of-age story in the books. You know, he changes and he grows and he develops. He becomes one of the wise, one of the great, as Saruman says bitterly in Bag End at the very end of The Return of the King. But it's not like a growing up thing that he's doing. And that's a really significant change. So that's in the context of our last episode when I was talking about Thorin, that's what I think is really interesting, that they seem to be doing a similar kind of thing here, that is in choosing to make him not 200 years old, but instead, I don't know how old he actually is, but anyway, he appears much younger. I think that they're going to, I mean, if Thorin were white bearded in the film, mm-hmm. I mean, if they were to slap a white beard on Richard Armitage, it would really change the starting point of his whole character trajectory. So that's what I was sort of speculating about last time, that the fact that we have a young appearing Thorin is, I think, going to make at least has the potential to give us some hints about the kind of character trajectory that he's likely to get. So,
yep.
Anyway, so yeah, I just wanted to explain that bit about Frodo's age, especially.
Okay, next one and last one we're going to do is from Facebook. Matthew Hershenroder, I think. Sorry, Matthew, if I butchered your last name. He had a comment on the split, which, of course, we're going to address in full in an upcoming episode, but I thought we would just comment on this suggestion. Basically, to paraphrase, he proposes that they might split the movies thematically rather than chronologically. Essentially, that one, the first movie would be basically The Hobbit. The second movie would be all the additional pieces that they're drawing from the other apocryphal sources that tell the larger story. That the first one would be Bilbo telling Frodo, "This is the real story of how I found the ring." The second one would be maybe even the second one would essentially be the Quest of Erebor story, where you start with, Frodo in Minas Tirith asking Gandalf, "Why on earth did you send Bilbo on that adventure?" He says he thought he heard a rumor about this in the early stages of the development of the script. And I'm curious to know what you think. I'm guessing this is not going to be the case. I don't think this would work too well. I think your average film going non-major Tolkien fan would be totally confused, but it's an interesting notion.
It is an interesting notion. I mean, I think I have pretty much the same reaction. I find it very implausible that they would actually do it. I think it's kind of interesting. I mean, I would be interested to see such a film, but I agree. I think it would appeal to a much smaller market, especially thinking back over The Lord of the Rings and how they did that. You know, Tolkien, of course, in his narrative proceeds not exactly thematically, but he proceeds in like different threads, right? So you've got, book three, that is the first half of The Two Towers, which follows Legolas and Gimli and Aragorn, and then Gandalf, of course, and Merry and Pippin, going back between them, and, culminating at Helm's Deep and then at Isengard. While meanwhile, Frodo and Sam have been doing something else, which we hear nothing about until book four, and then book four follows them all the way through. So we kind of go backwards in time a little bit, and then by the end of book four with Frodo and Sam, they're already past the point where we ended book three, and then we jump backwards again to get out. You know, so that's how Tolkien proceeds, which is not chronologically, but they made the choice, and it was a very firm choice in the first films not to proceed that way, not to just follow particular threads or particular themes, but instead to give a sense of what is happening contemporaneously everywhere. So that's why they keep jumping from Frodo and Sam back to Minas Tirith, back over to Frodo and Sam, you know, up to Rohan. That's just sort of the way that they did it. And it's a little hard for me to imagine them not doing it that way, especially since you've got the two stories that are being coordinated. And, you know, again, the clearest thing about the material they're adding that isn't in the book itself is the White Council stuff, you know, the necromancer, the Gandalf, Galadriel, and Elrond stuff. That's been really clear. Ever since they cast Cate Blanchett, it was obvious that they were going to be doing this, that they're going to be spending a lot more time looking at the drama of the White Castle and its offensive against Sauron, who's still disguised as the necromancer. And so the timing of that with the quest of Bilbo and the dwarves is, I think, going to be important in order to build an overall, overall kind of dramatic arc to the story. And I think, you know, one of the big challenges is going to be to coordinate those two things. There was an obvious coordination between the Quest of the Ring Bearers part of the Lord of the Rings and the War of the Ring part of the Lord of the Rings. Because of course they rely on each other until you finally get the culmination where the ring is destroyed just in time to keep the armies from all being squashed like bugs before the Black Gate. And of course the advance of the Black Gate in order to draw the attention of Sauron away from the ring bearers to enable them. So the sort of the coordination of those two plots was really clear. The coordination mm-hmm. of the necromancer plot, the necromancer / White Council plot in The Hobbit, with the quest for Erebor plot is less obvious because mm-hmm. the two of them are not linked in any direct way. At least not in the books, not in, you know, is it a coincidence? No, you know, Gandalf does not suggest that it's just a coincidence that all that happened at the same time. In particular, the finding of the ring. However, again, there's not a clear direct link between them like there was in The Lord of the Rings. So therefore, the balance, I think, is going to be challenging for them to achieve because they're going to have to be connecting them. But it's for that reason, if they did separate them the way that that Matthew's suggesting, which, again, I find a really interesting idea. But if they did, it would really just sound like two stories which might have little to do with each other. And since they're already going to have a hard time doing that, I don't see them basically trying to do that with one hand behind their back. I think by chronologically juxtaposing them, they can build connection even where there isn't any. And I think that they would take advantage of that.
Yeah, and I think the major danger, just practically speaking, is that nobody would go watch the second movie. People would be like, well, that was The Hobbit.
Right.
And they would be, and if they did, they wouldn't like it because there wouldn't be any hobbits or any of that stuff. It would just be, it'd be a lot of Gandalf sitting around debating with Saruman and Galadriel over what to do, and it wouldn't be particularly interesting. So,
right, yes, exactly. Oh, I should add like a real time correction here. I was just noticing on Twitter that Eloriel has pointed out that I said 2014 about the second film, which is making her very sad. I meant 2013. It just feels like forever from now. So that was. I'm not suggesting the films are going to be delayed. I'm just saying that the second film seems like the infinite future from now. So
that's hilarious.
Anyway, sorry.
Thank you for that real time correction. Okay, two last pieces of listener feedback, which I just want to mention. There was a wonderful discussion between Sarah and Feyerund and a few others about the Frodo-Bilbo framing device and how that will be used. I think that warrants an episode later.
Yeah, I agree.
And then there was also a really, really, I loved it, conversation about music and its relationship to humor a little bit. That definitely warrants at least one episode later on. I think we're going to definitely spend some time on the songs of The Hobbit because I know you love them. And then
I was going to say, don't think we're going to get away without talking about poetry.
Yes. That really deserves some predictions about whether those which songs will show up and in what form. So we promise we will get to those. Okay, let's.
Yes, and the vexed tra-la-la-lolly question.
Yes. It's looking increasingly unlikely based on the footage we've seen, but I hold out hope.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've long since given up hope. In fact, it's like, you know, when I first heard about the, I've said this before, when I first heard, you know, the announcement of the Fellowship of the Ring film, the very first thought that crossed my mind was they're going to cut Tom Bombadil. Similarly, you know, like the very first thing, my very first thought about the Hobbit film when I heard about it was, yeah, well, they're not going to do Tra-la-la-lolly. I mean, that's pretty clear. we're not going to hear any elves saying, or if they, you know, like maybe as like a kind of inside joke, they will have, you know, some kind of ethereal Enya type, you know, with like the lyrics that say, you know, that like a ghostly tra-la-la or something in the background, but it is certainly not going to be the kind of spirit of the tra-la-la.
Yeah, actually
song.
That could be hilarious if they did Enya Gregorian chant, but they did it in, they could do it in Elvish so that we have to go and translate it and we'll be like, oh, they did it.
Right, it translates to tra-la-la-lolly here down in the valley. Yeah, exactly. I could totally see that happening.
Yes.
And if it did, I would laugh. But anyway, yeah.
All right.
Anyway, but here I am digressing.
So let's move on to...
certainly, definitely an episode there.
Yes. So let's move on to analyst feedback. There's just a couple of things from our analyst stuff that I wanted to mention to you that I thought you'd enjoy. One is Golden Star from Casual Stroll to Mordor proposed... I don't think I heard anyone else propose this possibility, but that the opening sequence of the film, since nearly everyone thinks they're going to be some kind of epic narrative monologue flashback thing, she proposed that it would be Gandalf sneaking into Dol Guldur and acquiring the map and key from Thrain. So not Smaug attacking the mountain, not Battle of Azanul Bazar or Thror or any of that. That's
really
an interesting
cool.
idea.
Love that. You know, I said something like that. I don't know when it was, a long time ago. But that's exactly like if I were doing it, I would totally have like the opening sequence be, you know, Gandalf in a sort of a quasi Middle Earth like James Bond sequence breaking into Dol Guldur. That's totally how I would do the opening credits too. I absolutely agree. That would be awesome. I don't think it's going to happen, but it would be awesome. It would be awesome.
It would be pretty awesome.
Gandalf undercover in Dol Guldur. Absolutely how I would start the film.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Golden Star and Merrick, this is back from our very first episode. Also, when they first sent over their theories, they also included, I don't know if you saw it, but they included a humorous one that was basically Thorin in the plot of Back to the Future. It was Gandalf having a plan that involved getting Shadowfax's like father or something up to 88 miles an hour to go back in time, and then the orcs show up and kill Gandalf, and Thorin runs away on the horse, and then accidentally gets up to 88 miles an hour, goes back in time, and then he has to try and reunite his parents at the under the mountain dance and make sure that the necromancer doesn't erase him from the future.
That seems unlikely. But yeah, actually, you know, though it raises an interesting question. You said his parents.
Yes.
Will we see any female dwarves?
Yes, that is a really good question.
Will a female dwarf appear on screen? I'm going to go with yes, actually, but
I think you're right. I think this is their last chance to really do it. So
it's their only chance. And the attack on Erebor by Smaug, like having some dwarf women running around in panic while everybody is running around in panic, would be the moment, right? I mean, that would be clearly there were females in Erebor. But yeah. So no, that would be interesting. Or like Thorin's sister, Dees, the only named female dwarf.
Oh, she has to be in there, right?
In the entire Tolkien corpus, we get like Feely and Keely's mom. You know, like that. Yeah, come on, that'd be awesome. But we'll see.
Yes. Finally, I just wanted to let you know, Corey. We keep joking about your optimism. I noticed, looking back over the predictions, Mark Fisher from Encyclopedia of Arda has predicted A every time. And I think A every time has been I think they'll do it exactly as it's in the book.
Exactly like the book. Yeah. Hey, you know, look, I'm totally sympathetic, and I'm glad to hear that there's somebody who's more optimistic than I am, because that's unusual. So excellent. I know. I have great sympathy with his position.
And his points are always – they're not sentimental drivel. They're always well-reasoned. Yeah. It's always like, you know, I just don't think – I think that they, in order to deliver the story properly, they have to do X, Y, and Z. I'm like, well, that's a – Mark is by far was a fantastic addition to the game. He always sends excellent stuff. So.
Yeah, no, that's great.
By the way –
I have great sympathy for this. I hope he wins. That's all I say. I hope he wins.
Yeah, me too. I just wanted to mention, Aloriel on Twitter asked, if we see a female dwarf on screen, will we know?
Well, that's the challenge, of course. You know, especially since he set that up Peter Jackson set that up as a gag line in the Lord of the Rings films about the, you know, with the beards and everything. But honestly, that's actually why I think we will, because he's sort of created this like inside joke and this, but at the same time, do you want comedy in the middle of the like destruction of Erebor? The audience laughing as the dwarves are like screaming and dying at the beginning of the film, if that's when it happens. So, so it's a challenge. It's a challenge, but I mean, it's kind of hard. I kind of feel like he'd be backing down at this point. If
yes.
He didn't show.
Maybe it'll be an Easter egg that you won't know until you've watched it the fourth time
through. Yeah, it's
possible.
It's possible. You know that like we can like, did you spot the female dwarf? I think that could totally be a thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of humor, let's get to this week's topic. We're unofficially branding this one, and we will do this more formally like in a couple of months when we figure out this whole thing. But this is going to be the first of what we're referring to as our Bomber and Buffoonery series, which is going to be focused on humor in The Hobbit and how this will make the transition to the screen in the films. When I say series, I don't mean that the next four episodes will be on humor. I mean, these series are going to be spread, like we're going to have a whole bunch of these series going on, like series on main characters and series on dwarf backstory. And basically, as the topics come to us and we decide to do them, we'll decide like, oh, this is the next episode in our series. So this is the first humor one. I'm not saying the next 3 weeks will be humor. We're going to be doing humor for the next 2 years, I'm sure.
This is a major theme. So yeah, there are several like major topics that we're going to want to talk about over many different episodes and look at many different aspects of. And this is, I think, one of the biggest things. I mean, the people who have listened to my Hobbit series might remember that in Hobbit Lecture Number 1, which was the second podcast episode I ever posted on my feed, a lecture I wrote back in 2007, by the way. It's ancient now. So it was 2007, so there were only just rumors. This is while there was still an injunction against the Hobbit film by the Tolkien estate. We're talking ancient history. And at that point, my first comment about it was that, you know, I've heard that they're talking about doing a Hobbit film, and I think a really big challenge is going to be how are they going to handle the tone? You know, how are you going to have like an epic sequel to The Lord of the Rings? And I mean sequel as far as, you know, a film following up, while still, you know, without just completely departing from the really lighthearted and comical tone of the book. And so, I mean, I think that this was one of the things that I certainly conceived of as one of the primary challenges of trying to translate The Hobbit to film. And it seems, based upon stuff that we've seen, that they are not going to they're not just departing from that, that they are going to try to keep some of the fun and lightheartedness of the book, even though they are putting it, you know, in the larger epic scope as we've been talking about, and which makes sense because, again, as I've said, Tolkien did that, put the story of The Hobbit in the larger epic context, you know, after he wrote The Lord of the Rings. So So basically there are lots of different ways that we can kind of talk about this and lots of different issues. How are they going to represent Bilbo and the ways in which he is very comical in the books? How are they, you know, Bomber is sort of our poster child for buffoonery in The Hobbit, mostly because it alliterates, but also because, I mean, he is one of the most consistently, comical characters that he is the one in the book who does provide comic relief.
Yes. And also because there's the scene in the trailer that has him sitting on a chair, a table that collapses beneath his weight. So there's already an indication he'll be comedic relief in the films.
Right. Yes, exactly. So I do think that Anyway, so that's why we've chosen Bomber as our poster child for buffoonery. But anyway, so our topic, our specific angle that we want to take on this question today is the trolls. And this is a question that was asked of us on Twitter, way back after our first episode. And it's certainly something that I'm interested to say. And it, to me, makes a very interesting case study about the whole tone question. Because, of course, the trolls in the books are quite silly. You know, they are, I mean, there's something which even Tolkien himself had to kind of, well, not exactly justify, but had to work in. They are such a departure from trolls as he comes to depict them and wants to depict them in The Lord of the Rings. Because they speak with Cockney accents. They call each other silly names. But at the same time, you know, the thing that I would emphasize, as I emphasized in my Hobbit lecture on the troll chapter, Tolkien doesn't just make them silly. They're slapstick characters, but they're not only slapstick characters. They're slapstick characters who have, in fact, consumed a village and a half worth of people. I mean, they are murderers. They have victims. Victims whose clothes the dwarves find hanging in their cave, right? So we're reminded about the human beings that they have actually murdered and eaten. So it actually is kind of horrifying. But Tolkien, it's one of the places that I always point to when I'm talking about The Hobbit as one of the examples of where we can see Tolkien really being careful in the application of his tone to basically present a subject which is serious and which is scary, but to be kind of diffusing that with comedy so that it's not just horrifying, that it's not just overwhelming for the young children for whom this book was intended. So I think that we can see a balance between those two things in the book. But when you just look at the trolls as they're depicted in the books and think about what that would look like in the film, it's kind of challenging. It's hard to imagine the trolls are going to look exactly like that.
Yeah, that I was thinking about on this question is the contrast between trolls as they're presented in the books, the Lord of the Rings books, which is not really at all, the trolls in the films who are turned into sort of living battering rams, and monsters. And then the trolls in the Hobbit who are, as you mentioned, cutthroats and murderers, although it's extremely easy to forget that that's the case as you listen to their conversation, because they sound like, I don't know, working men discussing how to cook their meal. They're so like, so like surprisingly and superficially, I guess, civil and pedestrian in the way that they do it. And right. I'm trying to imagine that the giant so-called cave troll from the Chamber of Mazarbul scene in the Lord of the Rings films, sitting around with two of his friends talking about how to roast some dwarves, and it's like,
suggesting when he catches, like, to imagine that troll holding up, Bilbo, and suggesting that they catch several more and make a pie. Yeah, no, exactly. You can't imagine that. I mean, I can't imagine that. By the way, I just wanted to throw out there that there's an explicit reference back to the trolls from The Hobbit at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, and I don't mean, of course, when Frodo and the other hobbits and Aragorn get to the place where the troll statues are. But at the very beginning of The Shadow of the Past, chapter 2.
It's during the reporting of the news in the wider world, right?
Yes, exactly. Trolls were abroad, no longer dull-witted, but cunning and armed with dreadful weapons. So that's the sentence about no longer dull-witted, I think, is very clearly a reference back to The Hobbit. So, like, trolls are abroad, and not trolls like in The Hobbit anymore. These are cunning and armed trolls, because, of course, the trolls had no weapons either. Nobody had any weapons. It was a completely unarmed combat between Thorin and the trolls. You do not see a blade on either side. So I think that that sentence shows, and it's in the context talking about, you know, elves are abroad, orcs are multiplying, things are getting bad, there are rumors about the Dark Tower, and also there are trolls, but the trolls are different now. Don't expect Cockney trolls anymore, because that's not what you're going to see if you meet a troll. So even Tolkien seemed to feel the need to give that little cue, that little one-sentence cue to his readers at the beginning of The Fellowship of the Ring, that we're now in a different genre. You know, that now don't expect to see the same trolls that we saw. So, are we going to see the same trolls that we saw? Now, you can say, like, okay, you know, that cave troll from the Fellowship of the Ring film. Okay, so like he was not very bright. You know, he was not exactly like he wasn't like the honor roll student in his little troll clan. But maybe we have like a different species of trolls who are more articulate than he is, and so they make them look different to be like a different and more intelligent breed of troll. You can distinguish them visually in order to try to make that distinction. But yes, are they going to have that same? Are they going to have that cookery discussion? Are they going to debate about, are they going to suggest mincing the dwarves up and boiling them? It's hard to imagine. It really is.
And I think that could really slow down the pacing of the film. I can imagine a lot of people, especially people expecting a Lord of the Rings prequel, saying, you know, wondering why there was this 5 to 10 minute interlude early on in the film, just when things started going, with a discussion about how best to cook dwarves and a hobbit. I'm sort of wondering if what we're actually going to get is two things. The discussion will be shortened to like two lines, and they'll be delivered in some made up troll language with subtitles. So that it doesn't come across as like some guys with some Cockney accents with bad computer animation laid over the top of them.
I do like the subtitles idea, because that would be even funnier. I mean, I would laugh out loud, though I'm not sure I'd be laughing in quite the right way if, like, the bit about making a hobbit pie were in subtitles. Like, for some reason, I think I would find that 10 times funnier. But again, I'm not sure if I'd be laughing with them or laughing at them at that point. It's challenging. I could see it. I could see an exchange between them. It wouldn't surprise me if the trolls speak, like if they speak English on screen. That wouldn't shock me to see. In fact, I would kind of expect it. But it would be more of the, you know, like the way that we hear the orcs speaking English on screen, like when the orcs who capture Merry and Pippin, or the orcs who capture Frodo and Sam briefly in Mordor, you know, and we hear some exchanges among them. I would imagine the thing, but here's the issue. This is why I think that this scene is so, apart from the depiction of the trolls and the kind of the consequences for the choices that they make as far as the overall tone of the story and the preservation of its comedy. In addition, this is an important scene for two reasons. Thematically within the book, the troll scene is very important because this is the first moment. It's important for Bilbo more than anybody else because this is the first moment where this is Bilbo's first adventure. As Tolkien goes back and says, you know, the narrator in The Fellowship of the Ring, again, calls this Bilbo's first successful adventure, that it's kind of a big deal. But also, it's the first place where Bilbo is deliberately attempting to act as a burglar. He's trying to do what he was hired to do, and it's the first time he ever tries that. Bilbo being a burglar, you know, the burglarious career of Bilbo is a major theme in the book, and this is the first place where it actually comes into action, and it's kind of a disastrous failure, but it's still a beginning, as the narrator says that during that scene in the book. So, you know, one kind of question, and obviously we would talk about this more when we actually get around to talking about Bilbo, is how much is that theme going to be emphasized in the film. Are we going to get a lot of the burglar stuff in connection with Bilbo? But it's one of two reasons why I think you can't just cut or totally sideline. Why you can, but why I think it would be it's important not to just totally shove the scene off to the side or give it 10 seconds, because again, it's a really important moment in the development. It's a really important step in the development of Bilbo's character in the book. And so there's at least the opportunity for them to do a similar thing with that in the film, and it'd be interesting to see that. But the second reason, of course, why they can't just blow this scene off completely is that you have the physical trolls. Even in the Lord of the Rings films, they were there. In the extended edition, anyway. In the cinematic version, they cut it. But in the extended edition of the films, you remember when after Frodo has been stabbed and he comes around again, and there's Sam, you know, sort of hovering over him. He's like, "Look, it's Mr. Bilbo's trolls," and we get the statues of the trolls. So we. You know, unless Peter Jackson is going to be inconsistent with his own film, which I don't think he will, we know that the trolls will be in this. We know that the trolls are going to turn to stone. In fact, we know the posture they're going to be standing and sitting in when they do it, because we've seen them already in the Lord of the Rings films. So clearly this scene has to happen and can't just be tossed off. Therefore, these questions about tone and how they approach doing the scene, you know, that sort of their whole style of adapting this becomes important, because if they actually have to spend time on it, and they can't just sideline it, then they're going to have to make some choices about this. What kinds of jokes are they going to be making? Whom are we supposed to be laughing at, and how? Are there going to be cookery jokes? You know, are there, or if not exactly those jokes, are there going to be other jokes like that? Are the trolls going to be played as doofuses, as comic relief? Scary, powerful doofuses, but still doofuses that were supposed to laugh at, or not? And that, I think, is important, especially since this is so early on in the adventure. It helps to set the tone, or at least to transition the tone, really importantly. And again, thinking in terms of how they're going to be framing the films and everything, it leads to a kind of an extra challenge with that, I think.
Yeah, one of the things we were talking about last night when we were planning this episode is the fact that, at least for the particular prediction question we had on this scene, and I think this probably generalizes the scene in general, I think this is one of the first topics where you and I really, neither of us has a strong feeling about how it's going to be done.
Yes.
We really have no clue.
Yeah, no, I don't have a feeling for this at all. Because it's easy to see it going in a couple different directions. Do we want to, especially with the placement of this incident in the trajectory of Bilbo's adventure? I feel like trajectory is my word of the day today. Anyway,
yes.
With the placement of this incident in Bilbo's trajectory, it could be therefore taken in a bunch of different ways. This could be the place which transitions into action. You know, which is sort of the first action scene, maybe not of the film, if we do, you know, Thran or something like that, you know, Gandalf and Dol Guldur. But anyway, certainly Bilbo's first action moment, mm-hmm. you would think. So we could build up the action scene. You know, and basically, almost like they did the action scene. I mean, there were a couple action, like you get a little bit of action scene at Weathertop, but let's face it, the Hobbits don't do a great job with that. You know, you think about the Hobbits and their transition into action sequences in the first film. You got them running around and hiding in the woods from the Black Riders and barely making the ferry. That's their first little action sequence. Then you've got, and I might be forgetting things, but I don't think so. Then after that, you get Weathertop, which again is, they don't cover themselves with glory there. They don't really fight. So it's really not until Moria. It's really not until the fight with the cave troll that they get their first action when even in the book Sam slays his first orc. So that moment, that sort of transitional moment as they begin to be part, yeah, I could imagine in the film them basically taking the troll sequence here as a way to do that, as a way to introduce Bilbo to the adventurous action world, the world of danger that he's gone into. And thematically, I think that could work. So I could picture this. I could picture the troll sequence becoming a big, you know, a big epic action sequence. Totally could picture that. But I don't feel really strongly about that. I mean, I think there are many other ways that you could take it to, because there are other things that, you know, that it's especially because of its position, not at the very beginning, but close to the beginning. There's so many different directions you can take with it, depending which sort of overall theme they're really trying to develop at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the one thing that I would toss out is that we see in the trailer this very brief glimpse of a group of dwarves rushing what appear to be three large figures, most likely trolls, en masse. Sort of, which to me, of course, is not definitive, but it seems pretty clear that they're not going to do the dwarves wandering in one at a time and getting captured, which is not surprising, because that would be kind of ridiculous and extremely slow.
I mean, he even skips over it in the book. It's like pretty soon there were 11 of them.
Yes.
yes. Trying to imagine that on film would be tedious.
Yes. And so there's no reason why they couldn't follow the book closely from that point on. But to me, I think that's at least a strong piece of evidence that the take they're taking on the scene is more as an action sequence. And less as a, you know, comedic relief, sort of nice brief interlude, and let's observe the natural habits of trolls in the wild as they discuss how to prepare their meals, kind of, you know, like Discovery Channel sort of scene.
Right, the troll Discovery Channel and Cooking Network.
Yeah, actually, what it really is,
the Troll Food Network.
It's like an episode of Anthony Bourdain with trolls.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, I don't see them moving in that direction either. But I was going to say, you know, another thing, another function that this scene has in the books, it's kind of an understated function within the story itself. That is, at the moment, in chapter two of The Hobbit, it's not a major emphasis, but it's referred to later on. The narrator points to this moment as an example of basically the good-heartedness and faithfulness of the dwarves. Way forward, up in chapter 12, after Bilbo talks to Smaug, and Smaug has sort of sowed in his mind the seeds of doubt about the faithfulness of the dwarves and whether they're actually going to pay him and whether they're just setting him up and can he really trust them. Back when that's happening, the narrator recalls the troll scene and says that, like, you know, basically that, you know, they're not heroes. And, you know, if you don't expect too much, it's okay. But he says that, you know, Thorin and company were basically decent people. And they really intended to pay Bilbo very handsomely. And also they would have done everything they could for him if he got in trouble, as they did with the trolls, the narrator says, back before they had any particular reason of being grateful to him. So, at this point in the story, all of the dwarves still look down on him. They still think that he's useless and a joke. And yet, they do legitimately risk their lives and almost lose their lives for the sake of coming to rescue him when they think that he's been captured by the trolls. So, you could have – that is something that I could imagine if I were making a film about this, that we could play that up here, in which case – you don't want the trolls to be buffoons, because you would want this to be like Bilbo is in serious danger and we the dwarves are coming to rescue him, showing that they are good-hearted and noble despite the fact that they're not, you know, sort of beholden to Bilbo in any way at this point. They don't have any reason to be grateful to him, and they probably do still, even in the film, think he's a joke. So, but that could be something that they could really develop, I think.
Yep. Yeah, it is. I really don't know how they're going to do this scene.
Yeah. No, me neither. Me neither. But see, at the same time, I think they're trapped, because I think that this is one of the things that people are really going to be looking for. If the trolls in the Hobbit film are like the cave troll in the Chamber of Mazarbul, people are going to be outraged.
Yes.
If there's no buffoonery, you know, like, okay, maybe we don't get a reference to Hobbit pie, but you got to throw something, right? I mean, you get this, if they're not funny even a little bit, I think that's going to seem like a loss. So if it's just turned into epic action sequence and like, you know, buddy movie material, then I think you really lose something. Then that's a really significant choice when it comes to the overall tone of the film and their alteration of the tone of the book. So that's why I think this is such a, it's one of the things that makes this such an interesting moment, to think about, because it can really be pivotal, I think. But then again, if you do make them buffoons, if they're comic relief, then you lose at least much of the opportunity, or at least you make it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
To make this into, you know, a sort of a serious scene. Though again, Tolkien does both. It is, they are genuinely in danger. You know, comical discussions of cookery aside, the dwarves are actually going to be eaten by the trolls. You know, they are going to die.
Yeah.
And they know it. So, I mean, there is real threat. There's real danger. This is an actual adventure. And a deadly peril from which they're saved, even though it's funny almost throughout. So, you know, maybe they try to strike that balance too in the film. Maybe they attempt to have it both ways like Tolkien did. That would be challenging. In some ways, I think more challenging in film than in a book. But maybe that's what they'll try.
I think it's doable. I think they should try.
Yeah, because you could always, I mean, like the sort of the cop out way to do this is that like they're buffoons until they get really mad and then they just turn into like monstrous killing machines and then the action sequence is on. Like that would be one way to do it, which would be relatively simple. But in its way, that would be kind of disappointing. I mean, again, even just the fact that the dwarves have weapons puts the whole thing into a different context.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that this is going to be an armed combat, which is at least in that way more like the combat with the cave troll in the Chamber of Mazarbul than it is like the scuffle with the trolls that Thorin has in the book. Already that's a significant tonal decision, you know, stylistic decision, that I think is going to have consequences. And so I think that we do have that, because you're right, that scene in the trailer of the dwarves, it does, it's a little hard to tell, but it does look like, I think that does sort of suggest that they're going to be at least a little bit moving in this direction.
Yep, I agree. Okay, well, should we get on to our question?
Yeah, because we're kind of dancing around some of our options a little bit here, so we might as well spell it out to make the terms clear.
Okay. All right. So the prediction question of the week, which is related to the trolls, is, and addresses this question, I think, directly, how will the trolls' defeat and subsequent transformation to stone be portrayed on screen? Option A is, as always, the optimistic option. Gandalf will accomplish it precisely as he does in the book through sheer cleverness. Yes, that means we will get to see Ian McKellen hiding in the bushes and throwing his voice at the trolls.
Yes.
Option B is, it will happen via epic Lord of the Rings film-style action sequence, a la Chamber of Mazarbul. The dwarves, with Gandalf's help, will fight off the trolls long enough for the sun to rise. And we mean this to be sort of generally via action sequence.
Right.
So if it turns into like a chase scene, the dwarves, you know, hit the troll's toe and distract him and run away, and then the trolls are running, and then dawn happens and they turn to stone while they're running, which is not what their posture looks like as stone, but whatever.
Right.
But basically, via some form of action, basically the trolls are delayed from killing and eating the dwarves via action sequence as opposed to via Gandalf being clever.
Right.
Option C is, Gandalf will accomplish it via magic, directly or indirectly. And my little aside is, a decidedly un-Tolkien-like use of magic at that.
Right.
I don't think it's entirely implausible that Gandalf will intervene via magic in this scene, that's possibly how they will do this. And so obviously there's some potential overlap between B and C. And basically what we mean by B is action sequence with no magic, By C, we mean, by C, we mean there could be an action sequence, but that at the end, the troll's defeat will be accomplished via magic. And maybe that means Gandalf blasts them with a magic sun, spell or something. Or maybe it's indirectly that he somehow, like, entangles them in some weeds and then the sun comes up. But basically, magic. Option D is, the trolls will fall prey to their own stupidity. Basically, the dwarves will escape pursuit, and the trolls, crestfallen at their loss and utterly incapable of telling time, will forget about the approaching sunrise, and will just basically maybe will it get like a last little shot. We'll see the dwarves kind of resuming their journey, and then we'll go back to a last shot of the trolls standing around befuddled, and the sun will pop up, and they'll be like, "Ah, crap," and then turn to stone.
Right. Okay. So here are my thoughts about these. Is that so? Two things that I would want to mention. I think, for instance, that option D is like the purest second line of defense. That is to say, I think that option D is the one which is the second most like the way it happens in the book. Because of course, what does end up destroying the trolls in the book is not only their own stupidity, but their own greed and their own divisiveness. If they could just shut up and get along with each other, if they could work together better, and not be constantly at each other's throats and squabbling with each other, Gandalf's plan would not have worked, and they would not have been exposed to the sun. So they are really responsible, although Gandalf instigates it on purpose and they are destroyed as a consequence of his plan. Nevertheless, it's their own natures, it's their own choices that lead to their destruction. So D is kind of is to me it's like the purest backup to this. The option A, and basically I see the central difference between A and D being the intervention of Gandalf. Are we going to get Ian McKellen imitating a troll's voice and getting them fighting? Or is that not going to happen? Because that's trying to imagine that in film, trying to imagine Ian McKellen sitting and imitating the voice of a troll from the bushes. It's just Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings, Gandalf certainly in the Lord of the Rings films, has more dignity than that. You know, like it's hard to imagine, Ian McKellen's Gandalf doing that. So are we going to see that? Are we, or some other version? I would count A as correct if, you know, some Gandalf's cleverness, like he just not through magic and not through physical force, but does something devious, which leads to the downfall of the trolls. Now, option C, the reason we included option C is that it's, I actually consider option C plausible, that is Gandalf's magical intervention, because if we, you know, if say the filmmakers are thinking, well, you know, the synopsis of the destruction of the trolls is Gandalf rescues them from the trolls. Okay, so if we start with the premise, we want to show Gandalf coming and rescuing them from the trolls. All right, how do we do this? Do we do this by having him imitating a troll's voice from the bushes? No, that's kind of dorky. I don't think that would work very well on film. So what's their fallback position? If they want to have Gandalf rescue them, well, Gandalf is a wizard. Maybe he does something magic. You know, maybe they want to kind of elevate him and his power and show him doing something here so that he's influencing the scene not by cleverness, but by power. So I can imagine that. I'm not going to go with C, but I can. But that's why I think it a plausible suggestion.
All right.
What do you think? Are you ready to commit, Dave?
Not quite yet. I don't know, man. It's so tough. And I think one thing I want to just to clarify on option D. Option D doesn't exclude action or cleverness or magic, but basically what we're saying is that what will happen with option D is that Gandalf, through a combination of Gandalf and the dwarves working together, they will escape but they won't actually, but they will only accomplish their escape, and they will be gone from the scene by the time that the trolls turn to stone, which is now what happens. Options A, B, and C basically mean that the dwarves and Gandalf are still standing around in the proximity of the trolls when they turn to stone.
So it's like basically it's you know the point of this is sort of when we watch the films and ask the question, what causes the destruction of the, like, what is the cause of the destruction of the trolls? If the answer is Gandalf tricked them, then that's A. If the answer is, you know, they were physically stymied, they were fought or, you know, whatever, chased, well, like, it's, you know, it was through physical actions that led to their destruction, then that's B. If it's Gandalf's magic, it's C. And if it's the troll's own stupid fault, it's D.
So here's one possibility that I hadn't considered that actually is confounding our answers. Suppose it looks in sort of execution like A. In other words, we get the Gandalf ventriloquism type voice throwing act, but the suggestion on film is that he is accomplishing that through magic.
Then it's C.
Yes, I agree.
If we're gonna superimpose magic upon the ventriloquism thing, then it's clearly C. No questions. This though, of course, I certainly think that of all the questions we've asked so far, this is the one the correct answer to which could be most hotly debated when the time comes.
Yes.
But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yes, I concur. All right, are you ready to make a final answer?
Yes, I think I am.
I think I am as well.
Okay, I'm going to go with D. I'm going to go with the troll's own stupid fault. They are not fought or chased or, like, run away from into submission. Gandalf doesn't zap them or deceive them through magic, and we're not going to get mere trickery. I think that what is going to lead to their destruction is going to be, I think it's going to be their own stupid fault. I think that that's how we're going to get the buffoonery angle in there, that they can make it, basically, instead of the way that I suggested before, that is saying, have the trolls be buffoons and then, like, get angry and then the gloves come off, right? And then it becomes an action sequence. You could flip it and do it the other way around. Mm-hmm. That is to say, have it be kind of, you know, some indication of buffoonery, have there be a dramatic scene, which then, you know, and which then kind of ends comically, with the dwarves undoing themselves.
Yep.
I'm going with that one.
I think I like that answer because I think it's true in spirit to what happens in the book, even if in sort of details it's a little different. I like it. I like it a lot. I'm trying to decide if I like it enough to pick it. All right. I think I'm actually going to go with C, believe it or not.
I'm surprised.
My mind is drawn to this notion of doing the scene the way making doing basis doing essentially superficially the scene from the book, but adding the implication that it's magic. So not having sort of like, you know, I don't know. I basically, my thinking is that if you were to do that scene on film the way it is in the book, that viewers will naturally infer that magic is taking place because, you know, ventriloquism and voice throwing already looks kind of like magic. So I think that right. I think they'll do something. I don't think it'll happen exactly the way it is in the book, where there's this sort of long drawn out debate between the trolls. But basically, it'll be somewhat similar to what you just suggested, where the trolls are kind of these somewhat malevolent seeming beings. And that there'll just be a brief moment where Gandalf does something to confuse them, enabling the dwarves to escape and actually confuse them and causing them to be delayed till dawn, you know. But I think that he'll accomplish it through magic.
Okay. I can see this. I mean, I can see them. I can imagine them going in that direction to want to, because, you know, they have at times past, you know, in the films, amplified something that was already there with at least the implication of magic. Like, I'm thinking, for instance, here of Gandalf's appearance at the Battle of Helm's Deep, right? Mm-hmm. When him and his army charge down that improbably steep slope, and then he's like, you know, shining with white light, and you know, so it like, and the implication is that his power is overwhelming the orcs there. Yeah, of course, it's, you know, it's not. He makes a comment about it in the book. Gandalf does after the Battle of Helm's Deep, when, you know, when Théoden's like, "Mighty are you in wizardry, Gandalf?" And he's like, "Well, maybe, but I haven't shown it yet, right?" And it's, I didn't do anything but ride my horse around really fast.
Yeah, that's right. It's actually all the credit belongs to Shadowfax, but they gave it to Gandalf.
Right, 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 and to Arkenbrand and the men of Westfold for yes. like, you know, marching through the night. He says, but still, yeah, I mean, that's But nevertheless, to render that visually, to render the sort of dramatic intervention of Gandalf in the battle, sort of to make that more visually powerful, they did. It wasn't really clear what he was magically accomplishing exactly, but anyway, I mean, I think that they do. I think that they do. They do definitely amplify it that way. So I can imagine. I know that's not my prediction, but I can see it.
It's not completely implausible anyway. The all these answers, it's really the only one that seems implausible is A, that it will be done exactly as it is in the book.
Yes, yes, and watch that be right. I hope Mark Fisher picks it.
That's correct. Right. I was going to say I won't stop Mark Fisher from from picking it and coming up with a completely compelling argument as to why it must be that way.
I hope so.
Me too. Yes,
I really do.
I would like to see Ian McKellen hiding in the bushes, and then stepping forth and saying, "Dawn, take you all."
It's not. I can definitely see Ian McKellen delivering that line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, "Dawn, take you all and be stoned to you." That could work. That could work. But you know, we'll
what will he be doing when he delivers it?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
I'm excited.
I don't know. Yeah. 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 So anyway, good. All right. Well, I have to run to class.
Yes.
This has been a fun discussion, and as you know, we'll be definitely coming back to this overall theme, thinking of the ways that they're going to be adapting particular scenes or particular characters or particular aspects of particular characters in order to contribute to the overall tone and sort of the implications that those choices will have for the overall tone of the film. So we'll definitely be returning to this.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout our discussions here.
Yep. Very quickly, I just want to wrap up a few things. First, I want to thank our analysts, as always. I want to thank John DiBartolo and the Lonely Mountain Band for letting us use their music to add some color to the episodes. I want to tell listeners to keep the comments coming. I want to subtly encourage them, if they can discipline themselves to do it, to comment on the Mythgard page directly whenever possible. I not to say that we won't read the Facebook page or we don't like it, and same thing for Twitter. I think Twitter's kind of orthogonal. Twitter's sort of for short messages. But we really would like to get a lot of discussion on the Mythgard page directly. And it's easier for us when we're revisiting comments to go back to the Mythgard page. So I want to encourage people, like, you know, go comment on the Mythgard page if you can. If you're using Twitter, send your tweets to both of us. That's Tolkien Prof and Dave Kale, DaveKale, and use the Riddles in the Dark hashtag. And then finally, thank you, listeners, for listening. So,
excellent. I agree. That's right. Okay. So, thanks for listening, everybody, and Godspeed.